We're here to make a dent in the universe, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out all the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Brumner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them. Welcome back to another podcast with me, Nicole Brumner. And today we are recording from Iceland with an incredible guest, actually. Wait till you hear her CV. It's incredibly impressive. And that is Áslaug Magnúsdóttir. And she's an entrepreneur and investor and serves as the CEO and founder of Katla, a direct-to-consumer sustainable fashion brand. And we'll be going into this in a lot of detail, actually. She has launched several ventures within the fashion and hospitality industries, including the beautiful Six Senses Hotel Resorts and Spas in Iceland, luxury e-commerce site Moda Operandi, Tinker Tailor, a customization platform for fashion, and TSM, Capital, a retail and fashion investment company that she co-founded with industry legend Marvin Traub. She also served as a senior executive at Gilt Group, where she oversaw merchandising for top customers. And Ms. Magnúsdóttir started her career in fashion as an investment director of a UK-based family office specialising in buyouts of large Northern European retail chains. Early in her career, she served as the engagement manager at McKinsey & Co. and as a corporate attorney at Deloitte. Now, she is a Fulbeck Scholar and holds an MBA from Harvard Business School. Wow, I can't talk today. Harvard Business School. And is the first Icelandic woman to receive an MBA from Harvard. She has her master's from Duke University School of Law and an undergrad degree in law from the University of Iceland. She's also a contributor to Forbes, where she writes about sustainable fashion. Hello and welcome to my podcast, Áslaug. Thank you for being here today.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure. Now,
you've just come off a call with hundreds of women talking about, is it business or sustainable fashion?
Yes, I did a call with a large group of business women in Iceland. I am currently in Iceland. I'm originally from Iceland. And we were talking about Katla and sustainable fashion. So that was quite exciting.
Why don't we dive straight into Katla, actually, because sustainable fashion has shaped your career, but right now and for the last few years, the focus has been on Katla, which is American-based but Icelandic-focused. So take us through what it actually is.
So in the last few years, I've become increasingly, I've thought an increasing amount about the impact that the fashion world is having on our environment and all of the people involved. It's been kind of a thread through my career that I wanted to minimize waste in the industry. But really over the last few years, it's become kind of the focus, front and center focus. Yeah. And with Katla, I wanted to create a brand that would be designed to be as holistically sustainable as possible. And of course, it's not perfect. We still have a long way to go, but we really try to think about the various elements of the business model from the perspective of making them kind to the environment, to people, and to animals. So this relates to our fabric selection. It relates to we have a resale recycling program. So we tell our customers, if you are going to stop wearing our items, then please send them back to us. Don't throw them away. And we'll pay for the shipping back and we will look to resell them. Traceability is another very important aspect. Every Katla item has a unique tracking number. And you can go on to our site and type this in and learn about the history of your item. So you'll see who made the product, where did the fabric come from, how was the fabric processed from an environmental impact standpoint, etc. And then one aspect of Katla that I think is maybe the most unique to us is how we look at manufacturing. So in the traditional fashion industry, there's about 30 to 40% overproduction on average every season. And if you can find a way to tackle that, or at least a portion of that, then you're tackling a very big part of the problem. So with Katla, I really wanted to do that. So what we are doing is on-demand manufacturing. So as the orders come in from customers, we're making the items and then shipping them to them. And I realized that we would have to do this very fast because people may want to wait months for like a very high-end runway gown. Yeah. But when it comes to your more day-to-day items, most people don't really want to wait. So we are currently working on a 3 to 5 day turnaround of items you order on the site. And our goal is to get that down to 24 hours within the next year.
That's quite phenomenal. As someone who has made my own clothes for many years, I know how much work goes into this. And so to get it down to 24 hours is quite remarkable. Where are they manufactured?
So currently we're manufacturing everything in the United States. I would say 90% of our customer base currently is in the US. So we want to be close to our customers. And I decided we would start with a simple supply chain. And of course we want to know our manufacturers and we know them quite well and want to make sure there are good conditions and all of that. And we really focused on finding factories that believe in the same vision in terms of the future of the industry, that we need to move to a less wasteful way of manufacturing and that on-demand is an important part of the solution for the future. So we've partnered with some key factories that share that belief and are working with them to deliver quickly, and they are also working to really speed up their process. Now, to do this, obviously, the styles have been set up in their system up front, we are producing standard styles. They're not customized styles currently. Hope to get there eventually. But by having it standardized in their systems, they're able to do this quickly.
And what I really liked about is the tracking. So I was quite curious about how that actually worked. And it is a QR code that you can scan or a code that you can type in. And you do get free shipping and a credit back on future purchases. How often does this get utilized?
So, well, the tracking is actually something that people really love. And actually, it's become kind of a design element for us. Many of our items have this big tracking patch on the outside, as well as a big QR code. And many people have, or a growing number of people have started to associate that with our brand. And they like that. They see some of our clothes that don't have it on the outside, that have it on the inside, and they're like, no, I want this on the outside. But it's actually, so the tracking number takes you to the history of the garment. And then the QR code, actually, there we're bundling kind of content into your fashion. So we started with a generic QR code that takes you to our blog area that has content about sustainable fashion and has interviews with inspiring women. But we're now really about to take that to the next level and start differentiating the QR codes based on different products. So next week, for example, we're launching a collaboration with an artist, an Icelandic artist, and the QR code on her items will take you to behind the scenes of that artist and kind of her inspiration. And soon, we will be launching a collaboration with a fitness influencer and martial artist out of New York, and her QR code will take you to fitness videos that will be updated regularly. So we're kind of bundling content into the items. When it comes to the return of items, that has not been used very much yet. Katla is actually a quite young company, so we beta launched in November of 2019, and then we went full-blown live at the end of January 2020. So thankfully, not many people have retired their Cutla items yet.
And that speaks to the quality. I've got quality clothes and have always purchased quality clothes. And it's not uncommon now for me to wear things that are 15 years old even, that still look as good as the day I bought them, because they are quality and slow fashion rather than fast fashion.
Exactly. I think it's so important, and that's a very big aspect of how we look at sustainability, is to create fashion that is timeless, that you still want to wear this item in a few years, but also that it lasts. So both the manufacturing, but also the fabric. So we use a lot of natural fabrics and a lot of organic cotton that's been GOT certified. It feels really good on your skin. And we during COVID time, we've sold a lot of hoodies and sweatsuits. Yeah. And many people have told me that they wear their hoodies like every day, that they've been wearing them every day during COVID and washing them again and again and again. And they still look great. So I'm very, very happy about that.
Yeah, it's so good feeling that comfort of natural fibers. Just interestingly and anecdotally, yesterday, my 9-year-old daughter was on the phone to one of her friends, or on a Skype call. No, it's not Skype. I don't know. Whatever the kids do now. I'm aging myself and sounding like a boomer, as my kids say. But I think they were on Snapchat calling each other, looking at costumes for World Book Day. And my daughter showed her friend this costume and she went, "Ew, it's polyester." Oh. And I thought, isn't that interesting that 9-year-old girls now are aware of what they're putting against their skin, and not just the discomfort, but it's actually repugnant to them to think about that. And that is fascinating, isn't it?
That's really, really great to hear that she has that awareness, and that is trickling down so broadly. Yeah. As I mentioned, we're very careful in terms of the fabrics we use. For some categories of fabric, like athletic wear, we do use some synthetics, but they are recycled. So we use recycled ocean plastics in our leggings, etc. But I would say 90% of our clothing is made of plant-based fabrics.
And it's one thing I just wanted to touch on. I know it's not an area of expertise for you, but we had a great conversation about this when I first had our call together. And that's about the health of these products against our skin, and how we need to be more aware of where our fabrics have come from, the raw materials for our fabrics, with the pesticides and being GMO-free and things like that, and how that impacts our health. Yeah. Are people becoming more aware of this as well?
I really do think they are becoming more aware. It's interesting, though, if you look at the things we use in our everyday lives, right? We all eat food. And if you look at what are the requirements for labeling of food, they are very extensive. For example, you look at the U.S. market. And that came later, though, than people think. But if you look at clothing, which we also put on our bodies every day, the requirements in terms of informing the customer what they're made of are very limited. I mean, yes, you're supposed to say the type of fabric, but where it came from, how it was processed, etc., the requirements are very, very limited. So customers, however, now are more and more are starting to demand this information. And I think that is a very important thing. So we're starting to see some apps that are providing information about our clothing. So one called Good On You, and that's kind of ranking it based on its impact on environment and animals and people. And I do believe that over the coming months and years, we will see a very big push in this direction, that customers are really going to ask for more and more information about this. And that's one of the things we wanted to get ahead of with the tracking tool that we have, to have very rich information for our customers about their clothing.
That is interesting, isn't it, about the labeling, and what the labeling doesn't tell you is what the conditions were like in the factories. And this is another thing that you've talked and written for Forbes quite a lot about as well, is it's not just about the waste of the garments, but also about this the conditions within these manufacturers and the wages they're being paid.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, it's still very prevalent in the fashion industry that workers are working around the world in factories that are not safe and for wages that are extraordinarily low. And it's actually somewhat shocking that even closer to home, there was an article in the Times last year that discussed factories in Los Angeles where the conditions are unsafe and where workers are being paid significantly under minimum wage. So it's extraordinary how many brands actually aren't even aware of the conditions that their own clothing is being made in. So I do believe that brands and big brands have a big responsibility to clean up this supply chain. But I think it's also important to ask consumers to really start, paying attention to this. And you'll see cheaper clothes that have been made in bad conditions, but really, can we really afford to continue mm-hmm. to buy cheaper clothes that are having such a negative impact on people and our world? So I think we have to kind of, as consumers, to really start thinking about that and making decisions that have a positive impact overall. Buying fewer mm-hmm. items and, yeah.
Yeah, that is a great start. And you wrote an excellent article about that, saying, can you really afford that $10 little black dress? And yeah. It's hard to know where the fault, for want of a better word, lies, because I do go into, say, my local Blue Water when we're not in lockdown and see queues of young girls outside Primark, H&M, and yeah. Zara. Well, Zara's probably not quite so bad, but not wanting to name and shame, but when you're buying something for £2, £3, £4, how can that be a good and a sustainable purchase from any perspective?
Yeah, I mean, when it's at that price, in the world as it is today, I mean, hopefully there will be technical solutions in the future that are able to provide in a sustainable way clothing at much lower mm-hmm. prices. But if you're buying something at that price today, then there is probably something wrong in the supply chain. Now, if you're talking about young girls waiting outside of these stores, many of them simply don't know. There is an increasing amount of awareness, but I don't think there is yet a full awareness or broad enough awareness of the impact of the industry. But also for a budget conscious shopper, which most young women or young mm-hmm. people are, we need to have alternatives. So we need to have sustainable alternatives that still fit within their budget. And we just don't have enough of those yet. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the issue is also just how the fashion industry has thought about their profitability. It's been very focused on just minimizing this unit cost and neglecting the fact that if you're overproducing to minimize this unit cost, you're creating another inefficiency and your overall profitability might not be as high. So rather try to think about the profitability of your business more holistically. And then I think, you can be putting better practices in place when it comes to making these items. But there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of education to be done, and it is very important that the big fashion companies really step up and take responsibility.
Yeah, and the argument from consumers is always going to be that sustainable fashion is unaffordable. And this is what you say, that the fashion industry then needs to react to that and find a solution. And one of the solutions you've said is that with only a small number of consumers like yourself and myself will actually pay a premium for sustainable fashion, and we value it. But it's about now providing a solution for the masses. And you were saying that one answer is to have more responsive supply chains, so that there is this print on demand type model for the more on trend items, while where the more essential items are priced higher, but the more, I guess, the prints of the season and the color of the season are more of a print on demand type model.
Yeah, I think this is a critical element for solving part of this problem, and it goes back to this factor around all the waste. If we are able to, with a traditional business overproducing by 30 to 40%, mm-hmm. think about all the savings if they didn't overproduce by 30 to 40%, and instead they could use that money to buy better fabrics and pay slightly higher wages. And so I think one of the solutions to avoid that overproduction is to be more responsive in the manufacturing. So to either do it completely on demand, like we're doing with Katla largely, or at least have a much faster cycle. So you have a much better understanding of what your customers are likely to buy in the coming 2 to 3 weeks. And better match the supply and demand. The traditional fashion industry entailed producing months in advance of sales and far away. So when the items came and started selling, you know, however good you are at predicting, nobody can get that right months in advance. And so both, there were a lot of excess inventory, but the other factor which impacts profitability is the best-selling items would sell out quickly, and there hasn't been an opportunity to replenish that. So if you have a system that's allowing you to replenish the styles that are selling really well, then you know you're improving your economics through that. And all of this can lead to you taking other decisions when it comes to your unit costs of production, and including the labor and the fabric.
Yeah, and then you can be more nimble as to replenishing stocks where there is demand and not with the others. Back in 2008, I was a retail analyst at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street. And I remember reading that Zara Group could go from concept to being in stores within 10 days.
Yeah.
And that's extraordinary. And it seems like that sort of system needs to be rolled out across the high street chains in order for it to be more sustainable.
Absolutely. Clearly that was an extraordinary success factor for Zara to be able to do that. And that type of thinking about manufacturing is very important. And then you need to add on to that, that the fabrics are good for the environment and that the factories are good. And I'm not commenting on Sarah specifically, but all of those three elements need to come together.
But yes, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. While it's good in one way, it's not looking at the sustainability of the actual fabrics. And that, again, we go back to manufacturers are saying that the cost of manufacturing sustainable fabrics is around 20% higher. So that would then add this 20% margin onto the cost of something from, say, at Zara, which then gets you into cutter type prices, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is still room. And I do believe that over time, with technology and innovation, that we will be able to reduce the cost of producing sustainably. So, and a lot of people are working on tackling that. There's a lot of innovation with respect to fabrics, et cetera. But there needs to be more innovation with respect to the manufacturing side as well. So I think we'll get there gradually, but so many things have to come together. I think in the meanwhile, to the extent that consumers stop feeling like they need to have new clothes all of the time, and that we can feel that we actually can buy some quality pieces, maybe we pay a little bit more for them, but we can wear them again and again, and that's okay. And that it's cool actually to wear the same thing again and again. Like, we need that shift in mentality to happen as well.
Oh, absolutely. But this does seem to me to be a more modern phenomenon, this need to have the latest fashion really quickly, because I remember when I was young, some 25, 30 years ago, we didn't have fast fashion. We had high-end fashion, or you had your department store, but I'm talking Target type fashion. And then there wasn't anything in between. So if you couldn't afford the top brands, you bought vintage, which is a sustainable way of dressing. So it does seem that this is a new type of trend that has emerged over the last 20 years.
Yeah. And I think there are a couple of factors. And I think, the amount of media that we all have access to now, and we're all seeing the runway, and, you know, we're inundated with these images of, oh, this is what we should be wearing, and this is what the style is now. And then what's accentuated that is social media, where people are posting images of themselves and they don't want to be wearing the same item again and again and in their pictures. It's been nice to see, though, kind of in the last couple of years, influencers on social media posting, saying, I'm wearing the same thing the third day in a row. And, you know, those types of things are nice to see. But there seems to also be a big, push towards vintage again. So many younger consumers are aware of the issues are moving towards vintage as kind of a less expensive option to be sustainable. And we've seen some big successes with companies now, like The Real Real, specializing in selling pre-owned merchandise. So that's a very good trend as well.
That's right. And things, I can't remember the name of the site off the top of my head, but my niece, who's 14, 15, her and her friends all go and buy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pound items of this secondhand. It's kind of like an eBay, but just for fashion. And they all have a lot of fun going there and seeing who can repurpose the best and the cheapest outfit. And again, these are things that we need to embrace, don't we? This more individual style rather than this looking like everyone else.
100%. And it is really nice that the younger consumers are more and more, you know, if you analyze like social media data in both Europe and the US and by age group in terms of interest in sustainable fashion, it's really nice to see how high it is in those younger age groups. So that's bodes well for the future.
Yeah, it does. It does. I was fascinated. One other fashion stat that I want to put out there before we move on to something else is that fashion as an industry emits more carbon than the airlines and the maritime industries combined. And that was pre-COVID, when everyone stopped traveling, actually.
Yes.
How is that? What is that from? Is that from the transport, supply? How is it emitting so much?
Yeah, I mean, it is a mix of things. The manufacturing, obviously, is a part of it, but the transport is a very big part of it as well. So we are, and there is a movement now more towards more local production. But if you think about it, most fashion is being manufactured far away and then moved to the local markets and then sometimes being shipped back to the end consumer. Yeah. So you're bringing fashion and samples back and forth. Fashion items are being flown back and forth around the world too much, unfortunately. So to the extent that we can start localizing that would be a positive as well.
Yeah, now wanting to move along to your other passion and interest, and that's your eco travel. And when a topic comes up and you just keep hearing about it over and over again, and I was introduced to someone who's got an eco travel business, and then as I was saying to you before about the Maldives, where you've just been for 6 weeks.
I was just there for 6 weeks. I just got back on Saturday, yes.
But there is this real move towards eco-travel, and that's something that you're working in as well with your involvement with Six Senses. So tell me what you're doing with them.
Yes, so I am, along with a couple of other people, developing a Six Senses Iceland, which will be kind of the first resort of its kind in Iceland. We have, traditionally, there hasn't been much in terms of luxury travel options in Iceland, and we're introducing that. But also, this is meant to be a real destination resort where you can come, and it will actually, it's not in Reykjavik and it's not even close to Reykjavik. It's a 5 to 6 hour drive outside of Reykjavik, southeast coast of Iceland. And it's just in some of the most beautiful nature that you'll ever see. And so the idea is that people can come there, they can really immerse themselves in nature, they can take long hikes, they can go up on a glacier, they can look at ice caves, they can go horseback riding. And then Six Senses are very famous for their spas and their wellness programs. So that will also be a very big part of what we're doing. But yeah, I can't wait for it to open and stay there. I this time in the Maldives at Six Senses was, you know, really just so refreshing. It's so good to get out to a place like that for some time and you feel so refreshed afterwards. So
oh, incredibly jealous. It just sounds so lovely. Just the thought of having sun on my skin feels amazing right now. What I really liked about Six Senses is the first two intentions or purposes on their website are about the hosts and the host countries or places, things like local sensitivity and being responsible to the hosts and to the communities. And I thought that was a really lovely way of looking at it. Yes, sure, the customer is always right, and it is about having the customer involved. But if your supply chain, I guess, or your host and your community are not happy with what you're doing, then you're never going to be able to deliver a lovely experience for your customers.
Yeah, 100%. That is one of the things that I think is very beautiful about the Six Senses brand. They aren't cookie cutter hotels. Like each location has its unique elements and is meant to draw as much as possible from local culture, local food, etc. They try to source as much of the food items as they can locally, and have distinctive activities that relate to the local environments. And then every Six Senses hotel has a sustainability fund. So a portion of revenues goes into that fund and is meant to support a cause in the local community. So I think that's really important. Clearly Six Senses Iceland is not going to have the sunshine of the Maldives. But, having grown up in Iceland, I left Iceland for graduate school and hadn't really lived here for a very long time. I've been working most of my career in London and New York. And in the last couple of years, I really started to appreciate again what Iceland has to offer. I spent my teenage years trying to get out of Iceland. Yeah. And now I can't get enough of it because the nature here is spectacular. And so I think it's going to be a very beautiful experience for people.
It is absolutely breathtakingly beautiful in Iceland, and it's one place that's right at the top of my list to visit again. And I can't think of anywhere that would be a more beautiful setting for a spa and wellness hotel, as well as you've got crafted experiences, as you've said, and pioneering wellness, and also emotional hospitality, which I thought was really interesting. It's just being aware of the emotional side of hospitality, and also fun and quirky, which are probably two words that I would use to describe Icelandic people.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Icelandic people actually believe in elves. I don't know if you've heard this.
I haven't.
And the land where the hotel is being built is believed to have a lot of elves living in it. So actually the CEO of Six Senses, who is, he's originally from the UK and he's based in Singapore now, but this is one of his favorite things about the Six Senses in Iceland. And he loves to talk about it every time that he speaks about the project is the elves. And there will be an elf school for children at Six Senses Iceland.
That's fantastic. What about, and I was thinking about local cuisine. Does that mean we're going to have putrefied meat?
Well, there will be good meat. Iceland is known for having like amazing lamb, for example. Our sheep roam around freely, you know, all summer long. But the cuisine that we eat most of in Iceland is fish. We are very much a fishing nation. When I was growing up in Iceland, we would have fish 6 nights a week. And then meat on Sundays. Yeah. So that will be a very important part of what we say. Yeah.
No, it will be such a beautiful experience. I can't wait for it. It's opening in around 2 years, did you say? It's been built now. Yeah. A little bit more time. I also love the phrase, and I might have to borrow this, that six senses are a story doer, not a storyteller.
Yes.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it means that they want people to come and create memories there through special experiences and unique experiences that are unique to that place. So
yeah, I love that phrase. Yeah. So can you talk to me a bit more about growing up in Iceland? The things that I remember are the beautiful ponies, swimming in the pools no matter what the weather. And then obviously the breathtaking beauty, but also the very high alcohol prices. So tell me about just growing up in Iceland and what it was like.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because from age 5 to 11, I was living in California. Right. My parents moved to Los Angeles. And so I came back when I was 11, and they kind of dragged me kicking and screaming from California to Iceland. And it took a while to learn to appreciate it. I'm so happy now. But it was, at the time, a very homogenous society. There were no visitors. We kind of felt like nobody really wanted to come visit us. we would describe as living on a rock or an ice cube. I think Icelanders have a very deep appreciation of the nature. And despite, bitching a little bit about living on a rock, we really do love it. Families here are typically very close by. We have, very strong family ties. It's a nice place to grow up. It's a very safe place to grow up. Children are typically allowed to stay out into the evening. Clearly in the summer, it's bright all night. So you get to stay out very late in the summer. we didn't have any TV in the summer. No TV on Thursdays, so was watching much less television here. There wasn't the variety in cuisine at the time when I was growing up. It was all kind of, as I mentioned, we would eat fish six days a week. And all of this has changed a lot. But I definitely did learn to have a deep appreciation for nature the animal life here. A lot of people have horses. I used to love riding horses. So it's a good healthy life and a safe place. I think it's a good place to raise children.
And it's what I've always admired about Iceland is the preservation and the effort that goes into the preservation of the culture and the language things like the language. You won't have a separate name. Or Wi-Fi won't be Wi-Fi. You'll have an Icelandic name. Is that correct?
Yes. So our former president, Vigdís Finnbogadóttir, who became president in 1980, and she was president for 16 years, she was actually the first female head of state elected in a democratic election in the world. Mm-hmm. But this was one of her big causes, was to protect the Icelandic language. And so, yes, we always come up with a unique word for any new technology. We also have a book of allowed names. We can only name our children an approved name. And if somebody wants to take on citizenship in Iceland, they need to have an Icelandic name. And this book is not very big. It's like a book this thick of allowed names, which is kind of fun and interesting, but yeah.
That is fascinating. I was going to ask you about that, whether it was true or not, but yeah, that's, I guess it preserves that culture and identity.
Our language is still, quite close to the original Viking language. So Norwegians moved to Iceland at the end of the 800s, 874. And our language, Icelanders can still read, the sagas that were written back in the 1200s. And because people weren't traveling much to Iceland, the language was preserved. So whereas other Scandinavian languages were more influenced by German and English, ours has kind of stayed. We still have the old Viking language largely.
That is fascinating. Yeah. And how did then this young lady from California or Iceland, how did you then go back to the US to study and become the first person to get an MBA from Harvard?
I think the fact that I did live in California as a child did impact me. I always had this feeling that I wanted to go back. Both my father and grandfather had studied in the U.S. That's why we were there. But honestly, by the time I finally went, my plan was to go for 1 year to go to Duke and do my master in law. I had done my undergraduate in law in Iceland, and my plan was to go there and come straight back. And I was at the time working for Deloitte in Iceland. I was going to come back and take on a more senior role there. And once I was in the US, I decided, well, actually, I'm not ready to go back yet. I really want to have more of an international experience. And I decided that, it would be a little bit more challenging with law, because law is quite tied to the country where you studied law. And I'd always been interested in business as well. So I decided to go to business school and kind of broaden my perspective a little bit. And I felt like that would give me more opportunities to work internationally. And after business school, I never went back to law, even though it's always been a good foundation. And I didn't go back to Iceland until now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that is. And did you know at the time you're the only Icelandic person to have a Harvard MBA?
Well, I was the first. I was the first Icelandic woman, actually.
Woman. Okay.
Yeah. There was one guy before me. Yes, actually, when I went for my interview, I didn't know when I was applying, but when I went for my interview, the woman on campus who interviewed me, she said, "I think you might be the first woman." And she went and checked and confirmed. Yeah.
A lot must have changed in that time that you left and then came back. And it's interesting, having left Australia back in 2000 and not gone back. Every time I'm there, I notice and become more appreciative, like you said before, of some of the smaller things. What are some of the major things that you've seen that have changed about Iceland?
It's become a very popular tourist destination now, so that's very apparent. I mean, not as much now during COVID time. I mean, it's kind of like old Iceland now. Yeah. But looking back to 2019, all of a sudden you had people from lots of different cultures in the country. You would have people working now in restaurants and stores that didn't necessarily speak Icelandic, which was unheard of when I was growing up here. But we just didn't have, we don't have enough Icelanders actually there was negative unemployment here. So we had to bring in workforce from abroad. And now we have a lot more restaurants and a lot more variety in food. Iceland has always had, I think, interesting art and music, but there's even more of it now, and people like Björk kind of paved the way and made made younger Icelandic art musicians believe that they had an opportunity. And so we've seen a lot of, you know, great bands coming out of Iceland. I think it's just there's more diversity. Primarily is the biggest thing I see, which is great. We still thankfully have so much space and so much untouched nature that hasn't changed, and I hope that doesn't change. We are the most sparsely populated country in Europe. If you drive just 15 minutes outside of Reykjavik, you can be in the most amazing nature and feel like you're the only person in the world.
Yeah, part of it feel like you're on a planet in outer space or on the moon.
Yeah,
it's this almost lunar landscape.
Yes.
It's interesting.
When the lava fields.
Yeah, the lava fields, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, they're beautiful. It's just really interesting to contrast somewhere like Iceland with Malta, where Malta's the most built-up country in Europe and Iceland's the least, and they're just so different. It's incredible. And what's the future for you? You've obviously, you're very busy with Kapla and also with your Icelandic Six Senses, but what else can we expect to see from you?
Well, I think I need to focus on those two projects for the next few years. They're both big projects and very important to me. And I feel very blessed that I'm doing something in my career now that, you know, I'm very passionate about. And, you know, I've always been passionate about fashion, but to be able to now marry that with the sustainability aspect and of course, Six Senses has a big focus on sustainability. So to try to really help push the fashion industry in a positive direction, and you know, in addition to Kotla on its own, like I really would like to, you know, help educate the industry, like help push the thinking forward. All kind of ties in with what I'm doing with Kotla and with Six Senses. You know, my hope is to bring to Iceland a very special experience that will allow more people to come and experience Iceland and what it has to offer, and in terms of, you know, clean air and clean water and beautiful nature and healthy living. So I'll continue to focus on those two things for the next.
Put your hands full, especially working on an American-based business from Iceland. It must be quite a challenge.
Yes. The plan is ultimately to go back and spend more time in the US again. But I don't think, I think after this experience of COVID, I think I'll always be spending now going forward a lot of time in Iceland.
Yeah, and it's not a bad place to spend a lot of time, is it? Thank you, Ashleigh, so much for your time today. I've really appreciated it, and I've really appreciated talking about sustainable fashion. And I just want to finish with this lovely quote that you included in your last article from Mahatma Gandhi. And it's, "There is no beauty in the finest cloth if it makes hunger and unhappiness." And to me, that really defines what you're, not just Kotla, but also what this movement is about. It's about educating and inspiring people to think deeply about where their clothes have come from and where they're going to as well. So thank you for really pushing that movement. It's very important.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me on your show. Really appreciate it. And very nice to talk to you.
Yes, you too. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening. It's been another very interesting, as always, conversation, but this one's just very important. We need to be more mindful about where our clothes have come from and the impact that they're having, not just on our environment and our communities, but also on us personally and the impact on our health. And there are just so many impacts we're not aware of yet. So thank you very much. If you did like this episode, you know what to do. Rate, review, subscribe, and share with your friends as well. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe, and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.